Hello and welcome to Power Reflections, a proud member of the Doof Network, where we reflect on Wabo's most homegrown work as it releases. I'm Ruben Morehouse.
And I'm Elliot Diebold.
And we are here to talk about two chapters in Pale, one of which might be the best chapter that has ever happened. Is that right, Elliot?
I mean, that's my vote for sure. Yeah.
It's pretty up there. So we'll get to that in a moment. But first, just a quick note, which is that the Discord, which used to be a perk exclusively available to patrons who backed us, or who backed Doof Media on Patreon, that Discord is now open to everybody. So anyone can head in and discuss this show and any of our other shows, including shows like Game Club that are very community-focused, without having to be a patron at all. So if you want to do that, head on over to doofmedia.com/Discord and you can find the info there.
Yeah, there'll be a link to that in the show notes as well. So yeah, come join us. We talk about Pale, we talk about all the other things, Do the Right Thing, another community one. So yeah, Come check it out.
Yeah, perfect. Now let's get on with Shaking Hands 9.8, which is a great chapter, but has the unfortunate distinction of being paired with 9.9.
Yeah.
But it's still a good chapter. Sorry, 9.8. You're still good. You just pale in comparison, I guess.
Oh boy.
That was unintentional, but there we are. So we're in Avery's head. Avery's in the library looking for tickets or, you know, things that can be used for the entry to the Crypt of the Necrodancer path. She's looking for tickets when some rowdy kids in the library get in the way, and she distracts them by throwing Snowdrop at them effectively.
Yeah, I also just want to bring up, again, this chapter opens with, like, the heat wave being a really big thing. Like, it's kind of on Avery's mind for a lot of this chapter. And I'm just locking in once again that I think this is, like, a thing. No, like, I mean, don't get me wrong, I'll whinge till the cows come home if there's a heat wave here. But, like, in this world, I just feel like, you know, especially with our now confirmed culprit Edith being associated with, like, heat and flames. This is like a thing that actually matters in the setting.
Yeah, you're right. It's shown up a few times. Yeah. I wonder what implications that heat could have.
Yeah, I mean, the fact, especially, like, next chapter, like, Avery is kind of folding under the heat. It's not great imagery heading into confrontations with Edith.
You're right. You're very right. But yeah, this is a good Avery chapter. I mean, she continues to kind of go around taking care of business, making friends and taking names, basically. She meets this cute librarian who unfortunately has a boyfriend, sorry Avery, and is also like 10 years older than you at the absolute minimum.
You can't see it right now, but I'm winking. Because that's what the cool kids do.
That's what all the cool kids do. Yeah.
I love this moment where Avery, like, she takes those kids outside to distract them with Snowdrop. And she says to them, "Why don't you give the librarian a break?" And one of the boys is like, "It's funny though." And Avery just, like, looks at him and she's like, "Is it?" And he breaks eye contact. And it's just, when Avery's channeling her
inner Lucy, that is stone cold, for sure.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's brutal, and I loved it. Like, what a great way to challenge someone being shitty. Just, like, when they try to justify it, you're like, is it, though?
Can we then talk about this bit where, I mean, obviously these kids are very annoying, and the librarian isn't having a good time. She calls them shitbags, and then describes vividly having fantasies of murdering these children. And, yeah, I mean, Carmine Influence is the thing that comes to mind for this, obviously, but, I don't know, it just felt bad. Like, it felt, we've heard about this Carmine Influence a lot, but we haven't actually, I don't feel like we've seen that much that backs it up, right? But this is a pretty strong one.
Yeah, well, my understanding is that it's kind of like, it's only just starting to hit the innocence to this degree. Like, obviously crime's been going up, and we've been hearing about that, but it's kind of like, now we're sort of seeing how just normal people are starting to be affected by this.
Innocent people like this librarian or Verona's dad.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't know. I used to teach swimming, and having worked with kids, I can imagine being in a situation where if kids were doing this to me and it wasn't even meant to be my job, I don't think the library... I sympathize with what the librarian
is. Of course.
I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe it's just that kids are the worst, which is fair enough.
Yeah. The thing that does come to mind, especially since this is an Avery chapter, is the way this Carmine influence really seems to work with the innocents, at least at this point, is it's kind of like it both puts them more on edge. Like, you know, we're seeing these more vivid fantasies by the librarian of like how she would kill them, or at least you wouldn't normally tell someone about it. And then also, presumably, it's the sort of thing that, like, when it puts the kids on edge, it makes them more likely to piss someone off. So obviously, like, you know, that's a positive feedback loop of, you know, everyone's more on edge and people are more likely to do dumb things, which puts everyone else more on edge. And that obviously just has terrible effects for everyone's ability to like work together and be part of a team. And in an Avery chapter and a story that is in general talking about how we work together, that feels like it's going to become more and more important. Like this arc has already dealt with a bunch of people, and we'll get their next chapter, who can't seem to work with other people or don't want help. And it feels like the more the Carmine influence takes hold, the more that that's going to be the case.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, again, the Carmine influence is something that feels like it hasn't really had that much impact on the story yet, has it, right? But we feel like we have seen... I feel like we've heard so much discussion of it that I'm kind of like... I don't know. I guess I now expect it to play a major role in some way, but I just don't know what that is.
I think it's been this sort of subtle catalyst for a lot of things, in that it's like, you know, there are so many things that have happened in this story that would have been a you know, 5 out of 10, but they became an 8 out of 10 because of it.
Yeah, I guess that's true, but it's always, I guess because it's so subtle, it's hard to be like, oh, that was because of the Carmine influence, while Bo can't just be like, that one was Carmine influence, that one wasn't, etc.
Well, I suppose that's the thing about something like this is it's not the sole reason. It like exacerbates things. Like it's tipping stuff more off balance, I suppose. As an aside, as well, like Avery grabs all these invitations and stuff. From memory, of like the Forest Ribbon Trail and stuff, like what you use as the ribbons and, you know, obviously what animal you get for your boon companion, like affects how the path is shaped. Like, you know, because we know that paths can sort of be drastically different to each person. And something that's come up is like, for want of a better word, the ingredients you use to get there have an effect on how it manifests. Yeah. So like, I'm trying to read into what might happen to Avery's promenade based on the kinds of invitations she's pulling out here. Like, you know, she gets lots of ones to sporting events.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. And birthday stuff. Parties of lonely children.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, like, you know, I can't possibly speculate at this point, but I want to almost leave it as an exercise for after we go to the promenade and see what we see. I want to come back and be like, oh, maybe this came from. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, I could see that. Interesting. I wonder how that will play into it. Maybe just kind of theme a bit of Avery's involvement, I guess.
Yeah, I'm hoping that the birthday party ones give more credence to Miss showing up, just because you know, friends, family, sort of
inviting
vibe.
Your friend. Yeah, yeah, we'll see. So yeah, Avery collects these, you know, tickets and such. And then as she's starting to head out, she finds these pins, somebody desperately trying to put positivity out into the world. And she resolves to try and do more of that as well, as if she wasn't already.
Yeah, it's just nice to see someone else doing it, though, isn't it? Like, this is such a beautiful little moment.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And Avery's great here. I mean, like, obviously, she is so focused on connecting with people and being so genuine. And it's we've hit this beat a lot, but she's just so good at it. And I mean, we can compare this to the other Kenneteers and how they're so reluctant to like be trusting and be open with people for valid enough reasons. But
yeah,
I just just Avery continues to give my soul life.
Yeah, like this ties into all that stuff she said about like finding snowdrops out on the paths, right? Like she, so much of Avery is about putting positivity out into the world, and it just means so much to her to see somebody else doing that too. Yeah. And especially like up until now in this chapter, she's been dealing with assholes doing assholey things. So seeing this is just, it comforted me as much as it helped Avery, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good to get a bit of injection of positivity and wholesomeness into the chapter, isn't it? Into the story in general, I guess. So there's this moment where Avery has a bit of a minor confrontation with a woman who is like the parent of these children or something like that, right?
The grandma of some, yes. I think. Yeah.
And Avery flags that she might be aware. And I think this is interesting because I think this is kind of demonstrating to us the Carmine influence and the Carmine deadline approaching and shit getting weirder and weirder. I think we're seeing the otherification or awareification of more and more innocence. And I think this woman is a great example. And we'll get another good example, I think, next chapter.
Yeah, yeah, because they do touch on Melissa next chapter.
Sure. She also applies, I think, to an extent, but, you know, VD is obviously who I meant.
Well, yeah. Let's touch on that as well, because I'm not sure I fully agree, but when you brought this up, I was like, I had a thought, because I think this makes sense in a way, because, like, the rules of having innocence, that's part of Solomon's seal, isn't it? Like, I admit, I sometimes get a bit confused about what's actual and what's fan theory and blah, 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 but I feel like part of the agreement was that humans who live in, like, cities and stuff have that right to be innocent. Or maybe not necessarily innocence as part of the seal, but like the protection innocents get is part of Solomon's arrangement.
That's protection from others.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Not necessarily protection from, like, I don't know, like who's breaking the seal in that sense by this person.
No.
Turning into another. Right.
What I was sort of meant was, so if that protection of the innocents is sort of part of the seal and, you know, we're right that what's happening in Canada is the culprits are doing some kind of oni situation, it makes sense that part of what they're trying to do would like erode that protection of the innocents.
Right. Yes.
So,
yes.
So that idea that more of them are starting to become aware and more of them are going to become targetable by the others. Like if this becomes more and more of an area where those rules don't apply, innocence is going to matter less and less.
It theoretically could even become a bit of a hunting ground for others.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. I hadn't thought about it to that extent. I guess in that sense, I'd be worried for Ken. Who knows what would happen to him there, but yeah.
I think you're right that it's like, you know, again, the Carmine stuff is accelerating, you know, people's tracks to becoming aware and stuff if that's the path they're on. But there's been a lot of talk about like Melissa and what aware abilities she might get because, you know, like, I get the impression that not every aware has, you know, sort of things like a lot of Bristow's ones. It's just those are the ones he collected. Like he collected aware that had weird abilities and stuff. There might just be a lot of aware who just, you know, have a bunch of cats.
like this woman. Exactly. We kind of have a bit of selection bias for the aware that we've met in the story because they're the ones that Bristow has found useful. So,
yeah.
You know, they might just be some of them. Most of them might just be people who have run across things and it has fucked up their life in a really unhelpful way, e.g. Melissa or Verona's dad.
Yeah, but I think that the Carmine imbalance and stuff probably increases the chances that you get ones with odd powers or, like, gimmicks or whatever you want to call
even
it.
Just disruptive gimmicks, yeah.
Like, you know, we saw, like, Clem was commenting when she was here in Arc 5. It was like she found, like, 3 objects in one day, which should have taken months. Like, and there was a lot of talk that arc about how Kennet was accelerating who they were as aware. So it kind of makes sense that that applies further up the slope for someone like Melissa. Like she's probably charging down a lot quicker than she might normally.
Yeah.
So, yeah, she may end up with some kind of ability or something a lot sooner than she probably should.
Should, yeah. Yeah, interesting. Well, again, we'll have to see, right? I feel like, especially with the end of the next chapter, we're starting to kick off the final conflict territory. So, yeah. I'm assuming this stuff will come up pretty soon.
9.9 really fucked with where I thought the next, like, 10 chapters or so were going. I thought I had this picture of what we were doing, and I should know better by now. I've read enough Wild Bow stuff that I should know I can't predict where we're going to be.
You can't predict it. Because,
yeah.
Yeah. So, Avery prepares to rendezvous with the gang, but first takes the opportunity to create some of her special finder gear. First, she creates the finder's knot, which anchors others to reality a bit.
Yep, and of course this is a world based on meaning and stuff, so to give it power, she literally has to put her blood, sweat, and tears into it, which is just, what fun this world is.
Yep, good stuff. Yeah, I mean, just the fact that she has to think about the things that are making her cry in order to create this is just like shoving down your face, hey, these Kenneteers and their emotional trauma, which then, of course, pays off even more in the next chapter as the emotional trauma that Verona has been avoiding overflows again.
See, I think I'd actually kind of make the case that building something like the Finder's Knot is maybe a good or like therapeutic
a resolution way for it.
Working through this stuff, because it's like, I mean, the blood bit obviously isn't great because you just have to cut yourself and put blood into it. I'm not going to defend that part. But, like, the tears, it's like Avery has to sort of let herself cry about some of these sad things, which I think is healthy. And then also she gets to, like, use that to build something new and, like, awesome. So, like, that feels quite healthy to me, sort of letting yourself feel and then being able to channel that energy into something new and cool. She makes this, the Pokeball thing and her barometer bracelet. Those are really cool and helpful. So it's kind of like using that pain to very literally equip yourself to handle things better in the future. Like, that's what you want. If something terrible and bad does happen to you, using it to become stronger is kind of a best case scenario. And because this is the other verse, Avery gets to do that in a very literal way.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I guess the metaphorical counterpoint to that would be she's taking this this trauma or whatever, and rather than somehow processing it, she is like putting it into a thing that she will literally carry around with her for a while. But I don't know, maybe that's a slightly conflicting read, and I agree yours makes sense, especially the start of next chapter. Verona does something very similar where she talks about how the practice actually helps her process. So maybe you're right. Maybe it is just a different method for processing difficult emotions.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we'll see how it ends up being. Because, I mean, a lot of this stuff is very individual and context-dependent.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We'll just kind of have to see, I think. I guess part of my hope comes from the fact, like, Avery sort of goes on this big internal monologue about how she did play baseball for a bit, but, like, the league got ruined by parents and coaches who took it way too fucking seriously. And she had no one to have her back when they took away her stealing bases, like, ability. And so she kind of takes that memory of her being alone and sort of, you know, beaten down by the populace and brings it forward to make something really cool here. And she's doing something herself now. Like, she doesn't need the backup as much now. So I don't know. That it was like a lot of the imagery like that, I was like, I think this is good.
Yeah, fair enough.
Also, she's got that new knife now, like the really shit one. I guess this is the point I wanted to make. I was like, it's a knife that only works when you like drop water on it, but not too much water. Like, it sucks. I don't get, she seems to really like it, and I don't understand why.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't get it either. It doesn't seem... I think it's just Avery finding something and being like, ooh, this is cool, I want to try and make this work, even though it's a bit shit. I don't know.
She is sort of very proud of herself for, like, Veronering how it works.
Yeah, which is cool, but she doesn't go the step further to realize that it's a liability of a knife.
Yeah, like, you know, if this was Lucy, I feel like I'd be more inclined to be like, oh, it's kind of cool because it's a knife, but it's only violent when you want it to be, like, you know, otherwise it's mostly harmless. You could kind of string that together maybe, but, like, you know, sometimes it just rains. Yeah, I don't know. I don't get this knife.
Yep, me neither. I'm expecting it to come up again, you know, every tries and stabs something with a knife, but it's not raining, so instead it doesn't work or whatever.
Well, I suppose it'd be really good at the end of 9.9 if Avery can get into the basement with Verona.
Oh yeah, shit, this knife is made for that drizzly basement, huh?
Yeah, but it's kind of like, you know, if we got to fight Edith, if it's raining already, that's like 90% of the job done.
Yeah, the knife isn't really going to be the deciding factor. Yeah, there, is it? Yeah, so the other Kenneteers arrive with some goblins in tow, and they're planning on triangulating with compasses to figure out where the weird other is by tracking the depression in the you know, rolling the ball downhill kind of vibe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to touch on this other again, because it kind of seems like we're maybe going to skip out actually fighting it.
Yes.
But obviously the word depression has come up a lot around this thing in the, you know, the definition of depression that is like a hole. But the fact that it's like a big black cloud that sucks up bad energy, and we're using the word depression around it a lot, very naturally. I'm starting to think that's sort of what, like, it reminds me of the Doom in a way. I wonder if this is like a depression version of the Doom.
Interesting.
And I think that's really interesting because this thing's teamed up with New Gabe Plus, who has been compared to Edith. So we've kind of got an Edith alike working with a Doom alike. God knows what that could be foreshadowing or whatever.
Maybe they are dark mirrors of the original Kennet others. I mean, John, Marisica, Guillaume. I'm trying to see if any of the others would fit. They don't really, but maybe we'll see how they do. I've thought that we've had things before where we've been like, well, this kind of feels like this group is a mirror of that other group, but it doesn't really fit. And then like a week later, Wobbo will write something demonstrating very, very clearly how they do match each other. And we'd be like, oh, okay. So I'm assuming if that's the case, we'll see it again. Wobbo will be like, and actually this parasite other is a perfect representation of Alpi in this way that you never would have considered, you idiot.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, absolutely. I was definitely just focusing on the pair here. Yeah, I don't know. Like, I'm just... The fact that this thing's starting to remind me of the Doom, and the fact that New Gabe Plus is being compared to Edith, I'm like, this...
Yeah.
I almost think at this point what we're going to do soon is get an interlude of some of the others fighting New Gabe Plus and the Depression other, and that'll be really interesting to see, I think. Because, my sort of... not actually taking a shot at the dark theory is that these two are reflective of Edith and the Doom in some way that Wobbo will eventually have to spell out for us.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah, we'll see. We'll have to see. Avery mentions that she's planning on doing her familiar ritual tomorrow. I was going to say that's exciting, but given the way 9.9 ends, there's no way that plan goes ahead, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we already sort of touched on this, but it's like 9.9 just completely shat on everything I thought we were about to do. Although, interestingly, I think I should have double-checked the phrasing in this, but I'm pretty sure, like, Avery has sort of stated definitively that she's going to go to the promenade and, like, agreed to meet them there. So it's kind of like, even if the shit's going down because of practitioner bullshit, she might still be obligated to go. Which is very fun. Like, Avery having to run off and do the familiar ritual in the middle of Kennet burning down would be a very fun sort of mini arc.
It would be. Like, and, I mean, maybe that will happen just because of how wild it would be. But Avery...
It's sort of what happened with Lucy's implement ritual in a way, right? Like,
you're right. It was a way to kind of keep themselves out of a conflict. But this is a conflict they can't keep themselves out of, right?
No, it's a bit different because it's going to be, like, in the midst of the shit fighting, whereas, like, when they did the implement ritual, it was very much like, okay, you guys start this shit and we're just going to not be involved. And that obviously didn't work out long term, but yeah, I don't know. I think that would be very fun if like all the shit's going down the toilet. No, we still have to make this appointment.
Yeah. The thing that I could see meaning that it's going to happen is, well, I guess we'll get to this a bit next chapter, but I think it's relevant for this. Verona mentions that even finding the furs isn't going to be enough. They need to be more powerful. They need to have their rituals done. So maybe it is a thing where they're just going to have to do it because they need the power that these rituals will give them.
Oh, and I mean, also, if this path does turn into a way to potentially get Miss back, that's fucking hugely relevant.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Bringing back the old leader.
Will it? Is it good? It's definitely relevant. Would it be positive? We would have to see, right?
I can't imagine a situation where more Miss is bad, but...
Sure. I mean, I don't know. Also... I mean, you know, who knows how behind it she was, how involved she actually was.
I don't think she was. I think the girl... Like, we saw in her head in 5.D. She's legit. She's legit.
All right. Fair enough.
Also, can we just say, like, so Avery's plan is to actually do the familiar ritual on the promenade. She's sort of like, yeah, what we'll do is get there early, do the familiar ritual, and then, like, the others will arrive and you guys can, like, take notes off on the side. Which is just like, that's such a, like, to quote you, that's a mad last play right there. Like, that is insane.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Pretty good.
I mean, the other people got kicked off this path in, like, 2 minutes, didn't they say? Like, yeah.
It's a bit insane, but yeah.
It's so wild.
So, here's a fun beat. Verona gives the little goblin a name.
Yeah.
The little goblin's name is Pekka Snot. And we talked about the Discord at the start of this chapter. Funnily enough, this exact conversation came up in the Discord, like, 4 months ago, 5 months ago, something.
Yeah.
And you mentioned the name Snotpecker, and now 5 months later, Verona has in character burned you by telling you how wrong you were. So, oof, that's gotta hurt.
I mean, you say that, but the burn here is that I'm the same as Lucy. So, okay, like if I meant to feel bad for being on the same level as Lucy, I'll take it.
Fair enough, I guess. I mean, although Verona, you've said many times, Verona is your favorite Kenneteer, so...
oh, yeah.
You just got burned by your favorite Kenneteer, Elliot. That's gonna hurt.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, sure. It was funny, because it was, like, almost word for word. I was like, I think Snotpecker rolls off the tongue better. It was like, yeah, I needed the exact logic bomb Verona dropped on us. It was good. Pekka Snot, in general, continues to fascinate me. Like, I can't wait to see... Because something that sort of keeps happening to him is, like, Verona is helping him escape the really toxic, shitty parts of, like, goblin culture? I don't know if that works. I mean, people say Australian culture, so why not goblin culture? Like, you know, we saw this right back in 5.D when he was first introduced. Like, Pekka Snot isn't as naturally, like, violent and shitty as a lot of other goblins, but he kept getting dragged into it, and I'm so curious... Like, Verona is sort of pulling him out of those parts and giving him the freedom to be himself. And that, like, I can't wait to see where that goes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. It's interesting. What is that... What's going to... Like, is he going to become not a shitty goblin? Is he going to become, like, super chill? Is he going to become not a goblin at all? Yeah, who knows?
Exactly. Like that's what's going to be so fun to explore with this stuff. Is what does that mean? I can't wait.
Yeah, yeah. So the trio make plans to head home, but as they do, they notice something strange. There is interference with the compasses. Triangulating this, they think they might have found the furs.
Oh shit!
And it's just worth saying, we talked about in our pale predictions last week. A user called Snowdrop's Tiny Fan predicted that this would be the exact way that they would find the Carmine Furs. And it was 100% correct. So yeah. Well played, Snowdrop's Tiny Fan, for making a baller prediction that paid out 100%.
Yeah, a bang on the money. I like this as a cool thing because it is sort of explained that if they just made these compasses before the Depression Other was here, it wouldn't have worked. Because it is shielded, but it's like just because now there's interference, they can sort of backtrack it. It's
fine. They can kind of measure how much it's not working as it should, whereas before there wouldn't be a way that it should have worked, so it wouldn't have done anything.
Exactly. Which is just like, I can't wait to sort of, it sets it up as a limited opportunity, which I think is like immediately raises the stakes of like, okay, we've got until this depression other is handled to tackle this.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, it's really fun for this to unravel. Like, as they notice that it's acting weird, you're just kind of like, oh, that's weird. But then as they start to track it a bit more and it clicks, it's so baller. But we'll talk about that, obviously, a bit next chapter.
But you're right. That sort of delivery of, like, the puzzle, like, that's always one of my favorite parts of the Otherverse is when puzzles start to unravel themselves to the protagonist and you get to follow along with, like, them testing stuff and try to beat them to putting the logic together. It's very fun.
It is fun, isn't it? So let's get into Shaking Hands 9.9. We're in Vrona's head.
Do we have to?
Yeah, I know, right? Vrona starts out this chapter by listing all the ways that she likes not being human, which is a classic Vrona moment.
It's pretty great. It's sort of like, she just easily and immediately can list 5 cool things about being a crow right now. But she is very much struggling to motivate herself to go home and protect her dad. And I don't think any of us blamed her before and definitely not after.
Mm. Yeah. God, on second read of this chapter, seeing how this chapter ends up going, it's so clearly hinting at what's going to happen, but we've become so used to this kind of talk from Vrona that it's just like, yep, this is just Vrona things, move on.
Yeah, you're right. It's very much imprinting home bad into your head. I do want to point out, I think in last week's episode, we sort of talked a lot about how it's like, oh, this new dynamic with Vrona having power is really fun, yep. And I can't wait to see where it goes. I expected bounce back, but not this harsh and not this quick, I suppose. As fun as I expected. She hasn't even called her mum back, right? Like, that was a thing that was set up a few chapters ago.
Yeah.
So that's the next step is, if she emotionally recovers from what happens in this chapter, she also has to call her mum.
add that to the list of terrible piles of fuck. So I want to touch on this, the fourth beat that she pulls out here, which is effectively her saying that when she's not human, it allows her to assess and process her emotional state in a more of a safe way, right? And I think it's interesting because, like, obviously something that's important for emotional development of children is the ability to have kind of a safe place to process things. Vrona doesn't have that at home. What kind of is the closest thing to that was her room, but that is kind of violated this chapter. And so this is kind of the one that she has retreated to. This is her safe place where she feels like she can assess and process her emotions. Like, it's worrying that she has to literally become not a human to do that. But I don't know, that beat kind of reassured me a bit about the stuff that happens at the end of this chapter where she turns into a cat for what seems like, I mean, at the time I thought she was going to be a cat for like an arc or two.
I don't know, because I kind of came down differently on this. I'm not, I mean, yeah, like, obviously, I agree with you. Like, I'm pro anything that actually causes Vrona to introspect and learn to cope with and understand her emotions. Like, she clearly needs it. But I don't know. I feel like turning into a bird and flying above the city to kind of really muddle your emotions, I don't know if that's it. This is very much something that removes you from them further. And I guess as we see later in the chapter, I think she starts to use it in the distinctly unhealthy way later in the chapter. So I especially, like, even looking at the start here, I'm like, I don't know if this is it. I want you to get more in touch with your feelings, Vrona, but I think shuffling them away to see what happens isn't the way to do it.
Mm.
But I mean, hey, if it gets her motivated to start doing it, that's something. I mean, you know, you don't have to start optimally.
Yeah, I mean, I did like how reassuring it was, but having said that, we hear her say that this helps her process her emotions. We don't see her actually do it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, maybe we do. We do, but not when she's in this form. The closest we come is later in the chapter when she's a human. So, I don't know. Maybe you're right. Maybe it's not. Maybe she's just bullshitting us.
Yeah, I think she thinks it's true. I just don't think she's necessarily right. But yeah, I mean, she does do a cool new trick with the glamour where she, like, lands and fucking, like, all these crows scatter, like, from her thing. It's, like, the coolest fucking entrance bullshit ever. Like, you could tell she's sort of doing a superhero landing and this murder of crows flies out from where she landed. Like, I don't really have anything to say except I just fucking love that whole vibe.
Mm.
I'm just waiting for her to get a flying broom at this point. She's leaning into the witch aesthetic in such a cool way.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. That would be very cool. Verona. Such good times, huh?
And the other thing with the crow, like, vibe is part of why she does this trick is because she hasn't figured out how to do Lucy's one of splitting herself off into multiple foxes. And I wanted to touch on this because, you know, Verona is usually the one who clicks on this stuff the quickest, especially glamour. And so the fact that she can't figure out this trick that Lucy did, I feel like it comes back to what you sort of talked about with how, like, Lucy was in a way sort of splitting into the different parts of herself when she was turning into the multiple foxes. It was kind of like it took this really, I think what Lucy did took this really strong understanding of who she was and the sort of parts of herself. Mm. And as we've just kind of talked about, Verona doesn't quite have that, at least as naturally. So instead, what she does is comes out with an equivalent that's all about throwing a bunch of shit at the wall and deflecting, which is much more her speed.
Mm. Yeah. It's more her style. The crow trick is pretty great. I do love it.
Yeah. Well, and like, because the other little detail I noticed, and maybe I'm making this up, but like, whenever we see Verona in glamour, she often just talks about the body of whatever she is as herself. There's like occasional moments where she references herself being wrapped up in the animal. Like, she does it once in this chapter. She sort of references herself wrapped up in a crow.
Mm.
But for the most part, she just talks about the crow as if it's herself. Whereas when we saw Lucy use it earlier in the arc and when we've seen her use it historically, Lucy places a lot more emphasis on it being her wrapped up. And then occasionally talks about, like, the foxes as if they're her. Like, it's just this slightly different emphasis, but it's kind of like, I feel like Verona focuses more on the fact that she is this thing, and then occasionally she's wrapped up, whereas Lucy is much more still herself, wrapped up in something that she's occasionally tipping. And it's like, you know, it's like those little differences in how they use glamour come out in that sort of focus. And that's why, like, it's why Lucy was able to make the multiple foxes, because she's still thinking of herself while in that form more, whereas Verona just leans into the glamour a bit more.
Yeah, I mean, Verona's self, I think, isn't as strongly identified. Even in this chapter, she kind of talks about not knowing the kind of practitioner that she wants to be. And obviously, this, we know that yourself is the thing that kind of gets weakened over the course of all this emotional damage and trauma, right? So, yeah, I think that's great. I think that's a great pull.
Yeah, because I don't know that... Have we, like, ever seen Avery turn into an animal? At least since, like, arc 2 or 3? Like, she doesn't really do that much.
Mm. No, it's not a... She's not as keen on it as the others are, I guess.
No, she mostly uses glamour for those check marks.
Yep. Which are just as important.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, but again, that's just, like, she isn't wrapping herself up at all. She's just directly sort of adding to it.
Mm-hmm. So, Verona gets home and she tries to make it in, sorry, I've just realized in my notes I don't even reference Verona's dad. I just say she tries to make it in and out of the house without him noticing, assuming that we all know who I'm talking about, which if isn't just the strongest summary of the vibe of this chapter. But yeah, she tries to get in and out of the house without him noticing, and luckily she succeeds. She leaves with no issues and goes meeting up with Avery and Lucy, and it's all great. Isn't it, Elliot?
No, unfortunately, Brett finally stands up to his bratty daughter.
Yep. Good. He finally cracks down on his unruly... No. I genuinely, God, fuck. This is terrible.
I mean, before we dive into this whole mess, because we're obviously going to be on it for a while, I want to quickly touch on this moment fairly early on, as Verona gets down to the basement, where she starts texting Jeremy.
Mm.
Because I feel like this is just a little reminder that, like, she needs to be warding Jeremy's house too, right? Because I think any other in town worth their salt knows that Jeremy is just as good, if not more, like, an even better target than her dad if you want to fuck with Verona, right?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think Verona has clicked that that's the case.
No, but, like, I mean, yeah, like, I mean, like, Verona loves her dad, and I think, like, that's the thing that would really upset her, is she's going to get upset if he does get hurt. But in terms of, like, easier pickings, I feel like an other's just going to go for Jeremy, because he's, yeah, that's going to upset her in a whole different, but still just as intense way, I think.
Mm.
Like, she needs to either ward his house or get him to come and hang out with her dad for the day. Although, I suppose that kind of defeats the point of protecting him. He'd probably rather be tortured by one of the others.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. God. I didn't even think of it until you mentioned it, but Jeremy really is a vulnerability here, right? And Jeremy's connections to Verona are clearly defined enough that it wouldn't be too hard to figure that out.
Oh, yeah, especially if Marisica is one of the culprits, which, like, still seems pretty likely based on the whole awakening ritual coin thing.
Yeah.
There's no way she hasn't clicked onto that.
Yeah.
And, like, we have the added thing there that Jeremy is, you know, one of the backups for becoming a Kenneteer. Like, he's going to slip pretty easily into this stuff. If he does sort of get dragged into it, it's going to be a pretty steep and quick fall, I imagine, and that'll be very fun for us, not for him.
I mean, maybe he'll come out of it being a kick-ass practitioner. Who knows?
I don't think it's going to be a fun journey to get there, though.
Mm. Yeah, no, that's true. So, yeah, here we are in this chapter. I think the first thing to say is, when I was writing my notes, I almost called this the culmination of their relationship, but it's not, right? Like, this is a culmination of the beats with Verona and her dad, but it's not, it's an escalation of his abuse, but it's not resolved. It's not done. There's more coming. There's more resolution of this coming. And that's terrifying, I think.
Yeah, you're right. It's a big turning point. It's an escalation, but it's not, an ending yet. There's been lots of talk about, like, getting Lucy and Avery to finally step up, and you know, there was that time they promised to help Verona if things got worse with her dad. A lot of people have decided this qualifies. I would tend to agree. So we'll see where it continues to go. But yeah, at this point, it's not the end. It's just an escalation.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. It's rough. There's a lot of terrible stuff in here. I feel bad that I read Megafire's essay on the Reddit now, because I just want to pull in all their great points. I think a strong recommendation for everybody to go check out Megafire's essay on the Parahuman subreddit, because it is a categorical summary of all the ways that this abuse has built up, and clearly demonstrates with, like, brutal clarity the specifics of how much of an abuser VD has been up until now, and how this is not almost not even an escalation of his abuse, but just a continuation of it.
Yeah, exactly. I sort of had the same thing. There were, like, a few points after my live read I was planning to bring to this episode, that after I read Megafire's essay, it was like, well, Megafire just said it better and more comprehensively than I would have. So if you want a lot more discussion on this whole clusterfuck, definitely go read Megafire's post.
Yeah, definitely. One of the things I did want to pull out is the language in this chapter and how even before this conflict kicks off, because it doesn't kick off for a little bit, there's a lot of stuff that happens beforehand. But even before this conflict kicks off, the language in this chapter sets up so powerfully how fucking tense it is, how much of a presence her dad is, right? Obviously, we're tense when Verona's dad is in the picture regardless, but the language of the sheer amount of times her dad looms physically or mentally over her is horrifying. Mm. Like, it paints this picture of this man, the entire house just being this dark corner that he can suddenly spring up from behind and ruin your day, ruin your life.
Yeah, there's a lot of physicality used in this chapter in particular to define their interactions, like when he's, you know, holding the doors open, or later on when he's holding the backpack. Like, he's this big, immovable object for Verona, and he is using that a lot this chapter to try and exert that control over her.
And we've seen some of that before, obviously. I mean,
yeah,
him looming in a doorway has been a pretty strong image for how he acts over the course of this story, but it really does feel like we hit that beat a lot because it's building up to some horrifying stuff in this chapter.
Yep.
So Verona gets on a call with the others and wards the basement, as the other Kenneteers ward their house as well to protect their families.
Yeah, and I want to dwell on this bit for a while, not just because it's the positive moment sandwiched in between the horrors, but one of my biggest takeaways from this, like, warding segment was just, I've seen or read so many franchises and stories that have, like, runes in them. It's definitely a sort of trope in what's a fantasy and magic type stuff, but it's almost always just nonsense. Like, it's a bunch of random symbols, or at best it's sort of like you get a few of the basic ones and then they're put together in a big complex symbol, and it's like, just magic shit, like, you know, this is what it does. What I love so much about the rune system that's been built up in Pale is it's like we sort of follow step by step how Verona is building this thing, and some parts of it aren't even fully spelled out to us, because it's just we get told these are the shapes and the symbols she's using, and we can kind of put it all together. And that's, like, it's so cool, because it's not only, like, a more detailed and versatile rune system that I've seen anywhere else, including a book series that was entirely built on warding people and stuff, like The Warded Man, that book we read for Meteor MD. Like, not only is this better and more fleshed out and more detailed than that story's runes were, but it's only, like, a small part of the magic of this world. Like, again, I love the world building in the Otherverse so much that this is, like, we can follow the symbolism of an incredibly complex thing as our character makes it. And, yeah, so many other stories just don't have that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing about the Otherverse, right, is its tangibility. Everything feels so legitimate in this world, whether that's runes, which obviously, or the kind of magical systems as a whole, which feel very, very tangible, or even the characters and stuff like that, right? Everything feels so real. I think my favorite thing about this chapter is after it finished, you go straight to the Reddit comments or the comments on the actual WordPress site. And despite the fact that this chapter ends with possibly the biggest tangible plot progression that we've had in the entire story, everyone's just talking about the moments between Verona and her dad, because those character moments felt so genuine and real, that of course it dominates everyone's brain, even though it's not the, like, in air quotes, plot of the book that has just majorly been advanced.
No, yeah, I had the same thing. When I finished the chapter, the first thing I wanted to talk to people about was the stuff with Verona and her dad. not yeah. the fact that we...
Which is crazy to yeah. think about, but I just love that as a representation of how real and tangible everything feels.
Yeah, like, I was thinking about this after I read it, and it was like, you know, 2 years ago, before I'd really started reading Wabo stuff, if you'd, like, come up to me and said, yeah, okay, so we've been reading this story, we're about a million words in, which actually, side note, Pale's now longer than Pact. But anyway, yeah, it's just like, you know, if somebody came up to me and they're like, yeah, we're about a million words into this story, we finally found out who one of the major villains is. We found, like, this all-powerful artifact in the basement. Now the protagonist is trapped down there and she's trying to figure out how to escape with this super powerful thing that she can't control. But I didn't really care that much because her dad broke her backpack. like, I would have been like, you're an idiot. But, like, that's what it is. Like, that's actually just such a testament to Wabo's writing that it's like, what we care about a lot more is... the people, like, that's what makes the story in the end.
Yeah, it is. It is what defines, I think, why Wabo is such a great writer. Is, I mean, obviously, all this stuff works so well in tandem, right?
Well, yeah.
The fact that Verona has had this horrifying conflict with her dad, which makes her want to turn not human, which then is something that she can do in this world and has implications for the fact that it actually helps them find the furs. Like, the fact that she turns into a cat helps her get in and find the furs and take care of things, right? Like, it all works so flawlessly in concert together. It's perfect.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, I also just wanted to say, like, going back to the runes and stuff.
Yes.
Well, one thing I did, obviously, that I like about it as well, like, with that flexibility, is how, like, sometimes they just write annotations, because it always bothered me in other magic systems where it's like you use one symbol and it's like, oh, the magic just induits the gap. I like how they sometimes have to explain it here. And so, like, Verona sort of draws a link to the phone socket and adds her phone number and then also 911 to sort of set up the alarm system. And all I could think from that is, what do the people who answer the 911 call hear when the spirits...
What would they hear, yeah?
Because like, obviously, if Verona picks up her phone and it's like, you know, a jarbled number and some static on the line or whatever, she's going to be like, oh, this is the magical alarm I set up. Whereas, like, this poor 911 operator, like, what are they going to get?
I mean, you would hope that they would hear, like, Verona's dad screaming or whatever, and that's enough to send out a patrol car. But the thing that made me realize that was when Lucy said she's going to call her neighbor instead, and I was just kind of like, is the neighbor just going to be like, oh my god, I'm getting a call from this house, I must go investigate? I don't know.
I suppose your neighbors call you on the phone, it's like, just fucking walk over. Like, it's gonna be like, I don't need to answer this. Like, if you know, if it was really urgent, they just come over here. also, yeah, Avery providing some nice comedy in this moment with, like, her almost death in the attic. The way her brain is just melting under the heat again is so funny. Like, her amen that she chucks in, it was hilarious.
Good stuff. So, I mean, I wanted to pull out another example of this stuff with her dad looming. There was one I pulled out, which was from later in the chapter when Verona says, a feeling stuck with her, leaning on her like her dad in the doorway while she tried to close the door, which is...
Oh, it's good.
I mean, that's the metaphor that she goes to. Like, that demonstrates just how wild this is.
That's some good writing right there. I love that. Yeah, it just sort of demonstrates how much her dad is just, like, oppressing her entire thought pattern and psyche, which he has been for the whole story, but this is a nice tangible example as it's all escalating.
Yeah.
Especially because, like, that quote that you read out comes from, like, a larger paragraph of Verona thinking about, like, her own failures and, like, how she's not measuring up. And, like, so, you know, as she's thinking about how she's not good enough, it's like in her head, her dad is looming over her, reinforcing that image. It is just spot on. And then also, you kind of like the whole premise of her freaking out is she's like a 13-year-old girl who hasn't committed to, like, a lifelong decision. Like, she's sort of like, oh, I need to pick a speciality and I need to get, like, a familiar or a domain. It's like all of these things are lifelong commitments you can't really undo. So that's like, you're 13. Like, calm down. I get that you sort of need it in this situation, but also give yourself some slack for being 13 and not being ready to commit to something for your entire life.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, yeah, for sure, right? Like, this is the thing. Verona is a child.
Yeah.
The expectations that she has placed on herself and that the world and her father explicitly are placing on her are insane, right?
Yep.
But because she, you know, because no child wants to stop and say, actually, I'm a child, that's a hard conversation to have. I mean, giving Verona mad props, she does say that exact thing in this conversation with her dad. And
yep.
It's, I mean, there's no comeback to it. Like, you can't come back to it. Anyway, touched on this before, but this is the part where Verona thinks that having the furs isn't actually going to be enough. They still need more power, which is great because they find the furs. So obviously just stealing those isn't going to be enough while Bo is setting that up.
I mean, it's a start.
It's a start, and it's definitely obviously good.
Yeah. No, but I mean, like, this is something the arc has hit a number of times, this idea that, like, just getting the furs and finding out who done it is not the end of the road. Like, this isn't a whodunit story where, you know, we're sitting everyone down in the living room and being and revealing who done it, and then the story's kind of over and they go without a fuss. Like, this is unmasking the villains is the first step. It's not the end.
Yeah. We will see how it continues, I guess, later on. But yeah, so something interesting is Verona. We've been talking about, and Verona talks a lot about this pile of fuck that she is getting buried under. The things on her plate that are burying her, burning her out, overwhelming her. But it's worth saying, this chapter, it feels like she actually, up until obviously the part we're about to get to, it feels like she's actually making progress on that. Like, she talks about this, she talks about the things that she needs to prevent from building up. She has a moment before, a very, very cruel moment by Wild Bo, where as Verona is heading up the stairs, she's saying she felt good about this. All she needed was to keep this momentum going. And for reading that, you're like, yeah, Verona, you can pull yourself out of this. But obviously on the second read through, it's just Wild Bo fucking torturing one of his protagonists in the cruelest of ways.
Yeah, especially it let me get my hopes up a bit too, which is foolish.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, this is something like we've talked about a bit recently with, like, you know, Verona cleaning up at the police station and stuff. Like, she came across early in the story as so, like, anti doing chores or whatever. But, like, peppered throughout, there's always been things where it's like she doesn't hate work.
She doesn't hate hard work, yeah.
She just wants it to mean something or to have a point. And the way her dad treats chores and treats her, making her do them, has taken that out to the point where she's come against a lot of these things with, like, this is unnecessary and I hate it and it's terrible. And so you can sort of see here, like, you know, this isn't Verona looking at this big pile of fuck and thinking, like, oh, I just want to go and do cool magic, but I can't because there's all these jobs. It's her, like, looking at this list of stuff that she sees the point of doing and she knows she has to, and she's just reacting to it in a normal way, which is like, oh, it's too much of it. But it's not that, it's not that, like, you know, I think in arc 3 or something, I might have had the impression, oh, this is just, you know, the Verona who doesn't like having that much work. But it's not that. This is the normal, like, oh God, I'm drowning reaction to having 100 things to do.
Yeah. She's, it's not the fact that she has stuff to do, you're right. It's just that there is so much. And, like, God, her dad is just an endless font of fuck.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, Verona finishes up downstairs and heads up the stairs in a pretty good mood. Not for long.
Yeah. This is the part I suppose we've got to talk about.
Yes, it's so painful to read, and I wish that we could just skip over it and say, go check out Megafire's essay, but there's actually so much to talk about in here that we just can't do that.
Yeah, I had to actively stop in my live read pulling out every line that had me saying, like, oh, fuck, out loud.
Yeah.
It was just about every line at one point. Like, it just, like, Brett hits the bottom and then just keeps fucking digging.
Keeps digging, yeah.
And, like, the icing on top of all this is, like, Verona has just spent all that time down there, like, protecting him.
Yeah.
But she can't tell him, and he won't trust her on that. And honestly... Yeah,
what if she had told him, what would happen? He would, like, have found another thing to be a fuckwit about.
That's the thing. I was like, I reached the point where I was like, even if she could tell him, and even if he believed her, he'd still find a way to make it not good enough. And, like,
yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, like, this is the thing, because that's what, like, a loving, healthy relationship should be, is, like, Verona shouldn't have to be like, oh, I just spent all this time protecting you, because it should just be, like, implicit sort of stuff. Like, this is a very Avery sort of thing to be like, Avery would just expect her partner to do this for her, and she would just do this for her partner, and, like, without even sort of saying it. It's just, like, an assumed thing you would do for them if you have that capacity. But that's just not how Brett works, and that's why none of his relationships are healthy, because he's fucking keeping score.
Yeah, there's no... I mean, he's keeping score, but he's keeping score as well in a way that is just being a huge piece of shit.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so keeping score is, like, level one of his 10-level bullshittery that he's doing.
Yeah. So, let's get into it, shall we?
Yeah.
Here's the first thing that I thought during this, which is, there's this bit where Verona mentions, do you know how many times I almost died this summer or worse? And he just doesn't respond. And then Verona mentions, it doesn't matter. It was like he was broken. And I alluded to this before.
I was supposed to say, it's actually even worse than that. Because what she says is, she says, I tell you things and you don't listen. You just make it about you. I almost died. And his response is, well, I'm almost dying all the time with how much I work. It's like he does exactly what he did. Exactly. He does. Yeah. Like,
he's so unaware. ironically, because maybe he is aware. he's the most oblivious aware that we could ever imagine. Yeah, I don't know. Like, that tied with Rona explicitly saying it was like he was broken. I'm just like, we've thought of it for a while. We've made comparisons to how VD is effectively a ghost that just hasn't died yet. The other thing that this makes me think is, Verona's escape plan, so to speak, has always been, I could always just become an other. That's kind of what she's been keeping in her back pocket if things get really bad, right?
Yeah.
And what would ruin that more than her dad becoming an other first? Nothing, I think. And therefore, it's 100% confirmed that Verona's dad, I think, is either already some form of other/aware, or is going to become that by the end of the story.
Yeah, I mean, as we sort of already touched on, I feel like stuff like that is happening more easily with all the Carmine bullshit going on.
Yes.
Especially if the Kenneteers are about to pop the Furs out of this hut that is kind of containing a lot of their energy. But yeah, like, see, I don't know. There's something more horrifying about Brett and Verona's situation if he is just a guy. You know what I mean? Like, the idea that it becomes magically enhanced. I mean, you know, like, us and just about everyone reading the story has made jokes or comments about how he might become other or aware pretty much the whole story. But I think it's almost more terrifying because he is just still a normal human. It's like how that most scary X-Files episode is that one where it's just the crazy hillbilly people. Like, sometimes what's more scary than the magical is just the fact that Brett is still just, for all intents and purposes, a regular guy. So I almost, part of me almost hopes he doesn't end up being an other or an aware.
That's fair.
Because in a way, that's more horrifying.
No, I get that. And we've talked about how one of the great things about this chapter is that everyone has been talking the most about the least supernatural thing in the chapter, right? Which I do think is amazing. But I think it's just too juicy that would cut off Verona's escape route in such a tangible way. And it ironically might even push her to become more human to reject the authority of her father. Like, or flip side, maybe she'll end up like binding him or something, and that would be so many levels of fucked up. I don't know. I just think, yeah.
That would be a can of worms and a half, yep. wouldn't it?
Yeah, you're right that it would hurt some of these themes in a way that would make them less magical. But I think the great thing about this story is that doesn't...
Yeah.
In another story, I might care about that more. But in Pale and in Pact, magic isn't inhuman. Magic is
yeah
an extension, you know? And so, if anything, it kind of amplifies it. I don't know. I see what you're saying, but I also think it would just have so many interesting narrative payoffs that I just want it to happen.
Yeah. No, you're right in that it's so interesting how it ties into Verona's own battle with the concept of self and humanity in a really yeah. interesting way like that. And that's totally why it would work. If that is the direction we're going, because it's going to be more of a commentary on Verona's way of coping. Cause it's going to be saying, hey, see, what you were doing was trying to point yourself further down. This part, and because we've seen so much like so many of the Aware and like people like Nibble and Chloe, they all became others because shit wasn't working.
Yeah.
Yeah, and even Matt with the Doom. So yeah.
Mm.
The other thing that gets me, sort of just coming back to the Verona and Brett argument in general, is when you sort of get to the second half of it, what I hate is that a lot of valid and good points start to come up, but it's like, this is what happens in arguments when you're that far into it, the truth doesn't get heard as much because the people's tempers are already heated. I mean, in Brett's yeah. case, they probably wouldn't have been heard in the first place anyway because he's an idiot, but it sucks so much to hear Verona make these really clear and like concise summaries of what Brett is doing wrong and how he's hurting her, and he just can't hear it because they're in the middle of a argument. So many people do this when you're in a heated argument, you sort of almost switch more to win mode than to
it's trying more about to resolve scoring the points than actually exactly god it's rough.
And I mean, like, Brett even like the other worst part is that Brett also actually makes some points that are, at least maybe if they're not kind of true of Verona now, they were of who Verona used to be. Like he sort of criticizes her as someone who coasts and doesn't put effort in, and it's like, to be fair, at the start of the story, that is actually a fair criticism of who she was. This situation, that just kind of proves how detached he is from where she is now, because that's not who she is anymore.
She does so well. Vernie, you do so good here.
He calls Jazz a bad mom, which just like...
Yeah, fuck off.
Go fuck yourself.
Fuck right off, pal.
Like that might have been the bit that made my blood boil just the most, because
it's just so, I mean, it's good that it's in there because it is just so clearly, undeniably wrong in every single way that there's no way anyone can, like, you know, I think that we've obviously jumped off this train long ago, but at the start of the story, we were kind of able to empathize a bit with Brett and be like, he's trying to repair his relationship, blah, 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 right?
Mm.
Obviously, that ship has long since sailed, but this line almost to me feels like Wabo saying, hey, nobody can be on Brett's side anymore, and I'm going to make him call Jazz a bad mom to absolutely make sure that's the case.
Yeah, I mean, I still find myself, and it's the same thing with when we were with Melissa a couple of weeks ago. I'm always sitting here and I'm just like, I just want you to get help and I want you to be better. And I feel pity for you more than anything else until you open your mouth. It's like whenever Brett is actually on screen, I'm like, go fuck yourself with a cactus.
Yeah.
But then whenever he's off screen, like we're talking about him now and he's sort of what he did is in the past, is sort of separate. I can't help but just be like, God, he just needs help.
The thing is, we all want him to get help. We all want him to get better, obviously. But we, and definitely Verona, don't have a responsibility to be to him to help him or be culpable to him getting that help, right? Like, what the ideal state is, we don't tell him to get help. Verona doesn't have to push him to get help. He just goes and does it in the background of the story, because that's not Verona's responsibility. And by extension, it's not our responsibility to have to see that as an audience. It should just happen if he was not a piece of shit.
Yeah, the the closest it comes to being Verona's responsibility is a form of self-care, where if she can get him to get help, it helps her.
Yeah.
But, like, if that's going to be difficult for her, I'm not going to...
Which, yeah, it's already crossed that,
yeah, exactly.
Threshold.
But, yeah, like, I don't know. I'm so mad at him when I'm reading this, but I guess, like, when you take that sort of step back, I'm just like, well, anger doesn't help here. I just want him to go see a therapist, which is what Verona told him to do. I mean, like, as another little thing, he does so much, like, of that petty coup and claim bullshit, like, without knowing that's what he's doing, of course. But, like, he sounds like Bristow and Alexander at their worst when he's like, I pay for the backpack, so it's technically mine. And Megafire obviously went into why that's bullshit in terms of, like, being a parent. But it also just taps into, like, the worst parts of the magical world that we have here. Like, just to really reinforce how shitty he's being.
He's absolutely being the worst. And there's no way to... There's nothing that can be done. Clearly, he is too far beyond for any intervention from... I was about to say Victoria. Verona to have any impact.
Yeah. I did reach the point halfway through this live read where I was wondering how busy Nibble and Chloe are.
Jesus. That's... Oh, gosh. I mean, yeah, I get it.
Yeah. And then, yeah, we sort of hit this peak where he... smashes up. Well, yeah, he takes her backpack like a schoolyard bully and then, like, breaks it. Like, it's some Worm Arc 1 bullshit, what he does, right?
It is. Oh, gosh. Yeah. So, obviously, VD smashes her bag and breaks her mask, and when she takes it out, she reflects on how it was a gift from Lucy, and she even uses the words, a symbol of where she belonged, which, I mean, we talked about how Verona's self is hurting from all the stress and trauma that she's been under. This is literally a definition of her, like a tether to her friends and her humanity being broken, and we see presumably the impact of that shortly when she turns into an animal and just kind of shuts out her humanity to the strongest extent that she can.
Yeah, I mean, these masks are literally the symbols the magical world uses to identify these girls. Like, in people's sights, they have these masks as their faces. So, like, the fact that, like, VD has just cracked a huge important part of Verona's identity into pieces is an accurate metaphor. Yeah, like, I mean, the symbolism is just sort of right there on the table. She's been shattered by this. I mean, as an aside, it makes me wonder, like, have we kind of figured out exactly what Avery's broken prong means in that regard? Because that's something that came up last chapter as well. Like, she has this prong that broke off her mask, and it sometimes sort of sits back in there, but it's like, I can't figure out what part of herself it might map to that kind of got broken off in that fight against America.
Yeah, no, I don't think we really have, right? Or possibly there's been some stuff in chapters where that's been effective, the prong breaking, but we haven't really called it out, or it won't be obvious until in retrospect, maybe. I don't necessarily think that we've seen it have any impact.
Yeah, I can't think of it. Whereas, like, it just, that stands out to me now, because, like, what's happening with Verona's cat mask here is much more transparent in just, like, she has been shattered and now her mask has been too.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he broke the quill.
Yep. Yeah. It's rough. So yeah, Verona runs away, turning into a cat and putting everything out of her mind.
Yeah, it's that that escapism that we discussed at the start of the chapter, dialed up to 100.
Yeah. I mean, reading this, I thought there was a solid chance that Verona would just stay as a cat for an extended period of the story, and that doesn't happen. But God, we feel it. We feel the panic, and we feel the concern of Avery and Lucy when she's just non-communicative with them.
Yeah. Like that's the thing. I this is definitely like an escalation of how Verona has used glamour as an escape. Because something that is sort of not spelled out, but pretty clear in the text, is she's leaning more into being a cat. Like the reason she can't really talk is because to be a talking cat, she has to lean a little bit more into human, and doing that like puts her emotions too close. It's like, you know, if you compare this passage of her being a cat to like all the previous ones, her thinking is much more cat-like than normal. And she's like, she's pushing her humanity further away than she normally does to be more cat, which like obviously it just doesn't feel like it's healthy. And there's moments where Avery and Lucy actually have doubts that it's even her. Like that's how much she's leaning into cat instead of human.
I mean, that's a tangible representation of her having left her identity behind, right? Yeah. Or even her connection to her friends being broken a bit if they, for a moment, don't even recognize her.
Yeah, exactly. And like, you know, there could be longer-term sort of implications to this specific moment, because, like, we've already learned that Marcy's trick with this glamour is that, like, you know, Verona turning into a cat over and over reinforces it as, like, a groove that other people can also slip upon her. Like I think it was Shelley who like turned her into a cat against her will. So it's kind of like the fact that Verona is now not only like doing that groove again, but like pushing that groove further. Like she's turning herself more cat than she has in the past, which is pushing that groove further and making it like something Marisica could push, you know, even more on. And because like this is where it starts to get concerning, because she's going cat enough that like she's not all human anymore, cognitively.
And, yeah.
I mean that's a problem if somebody else does that to her. Obviously, and it's just a problem that she's doing that to herself.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like it ties back to like what that difference between her and Lucy and the way they use glamour is. Like I don't think Lucy would be capable of this in the same way. She would get lost and disconnected from herself accidentally, but I don't think she'd be able to push it away in that same way. She embraces herself with the glamour, not pushing it away.
I mean, you know, we know the weaknesses inherent and traps inherent within this glamour. So, given the fact that we're pretty certain a fairy is going to be involved with the plot, I'm sure we'll see Verena's gat form being used against her soon enough.
Yeah.
So did Verona turn into a cat in front of her dad? Did that happen?
No. That came across harsher than I meant.
Asked and answered.
Because you're not the first person who I've seen other people talking about that. We even got a Power Predictor prediction saying that she did that. But I mean, I've pulled it out in the script here, Ruba, like bolded it. There's a sentence where he leaves the room before she even gets to her backpack. So
you've pulled out the quote. I don't believe it. How could so many people have had the same thought?
I don't know. I've seen a lot of people. He left the room before she even gets to her backpack. There might be a bit of confusion because he talks to her after he leaves the room.
You're right.
But yeah, to everybody who keeps saying this, he left the room.
He leaves the room still talking to her. That's why it's confusing. Yeah. Okay. All right. Fair enough. The trio follow their compasses and track the irregularities to a cabin. Verona and Snowdrop find a way to burrow inside, and they find the furs.
I love how, as the four of them find the cabin and are like scoping it out and seeing someone who they can't identify yet, like walking inside, they start getting these texts about, "Oh, Melissa is out, and we need you to handle it." And I was just like, "Fuck off with this bullshit!" Every time we get close, there's distractions. Like, it's the biggest load of crap, and I'm so glad they just ignore it.
It's bullshit. It's clear. It's a clear distraction, right? So this didn't really click to me until the second read through, but the people who have the common furs are using it to make an outfit, and I don't know if this is intentional, but it gave me major Buffalo Bill vibes, like Silence of the Lambs style, making an outfit in a creepy basement of a murder victim. Like, nothing good comes from that, I guess.
Yeah, true.
It makes me want to pull out this thought, which is, we've often discussed the fact that it feels like this story isn't going to resolve with it just being like, oh, it was secretly me and I'm the villain and now we got to fight. We've had conversations about how when we find out who it is, we're presumably going to find out there are good reasons here. There are good reasons for what they've been doing. But I don't know. The fact that this makes me... this screams serial killer to me rather than, like, desperate struggle for survival doesn't necessarily reinforce that idea.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Edith's the obvious one to turn to, because we talked about this in the past, but it's like, if she's doing all of this to get powerful enough that she can, like, escape the doom, that's going to be one of those things where it's like, what you've done is monstrous and awful, but I do kind of, I get why you became.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I mean, something that jumped out to me about the outfit is it seems really incomplete, and I just wonder if maybe Matt and Edith, because they've had so much on their plate, like this is partially why they're just so tired all the time, because it's like they're trying to
keep watch here as well. Yeah,
and maybe they're behind schedule on putting the outfit together.
Yeah, I mean, they've talked about how they really didn't expect the Kenneteers to be as competent as they are, and in hindsight, maybe that's, and it has meant we've had to really accelerate our evil plans.
Well, not just that, but like losing the barrier and the Hungry Choir, like, you know, we talked about how much harder that's made it since then. So they just would have lost time because
there's too much to do.
Yeah, the maintenance of the town is taking more of their time than they probably expected.
They've got too much of a big pile of fuck they have to get through.
Yeah. Like, and Miss leaving is another one. Like, as long as Miss was running the town, they would have had much more time to do this. Yeah.
So, yeah, Snowdrop accidentally makes a noise and someone comes in. Edith, villain number one. She is apparently on the phone with Matthew, it seems, and then around them in the room are both goblin and fey traps. So we kind of are starting to put together who might be our villains.
Yeah.
Although Edith is the only one that's hard confirmed here, obviously.
Yeah, which makes sense. Like, the story has basically been telling us for 6 months now that Edith is a culprit. So, you know, it makes sense to hard confirm her first, just because it's like, it's the least reveal-y reveal that we could sort of have. It's like at our warm-up, basically. Yeah, the other ones are interesting. Like, I've seen a lot of tinfoiling about who else she could technically be on the phone with. But, I mean, Occam's Razor sort of, like, I'm going to assume it's Matt until proven otherwise, because it's just, you really have to tinfoil it into someone else to make it fit, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Indeed. So almost certainly Matthew is guilty here. Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Until shown otherwise, I'm just going to assume it's him and lump him
guilty. Yep.
The goblin and fae stuff, I'm much more willing to dive into the tinfoil of, like, it's such a hodgepodge of things that it's almost, I could see these having been stuff that was donated to the perimeter, and Matthew and Edith have just not used it for that.
Have used it for other things, exactly. I mean, we've obviously been suspicious of Marissica for a while, so.
Yeah.
Hot money is on her being involved. Goblin-wise, you know, Toadswallow has been a little sus sometimes, but then there's also been other things that mean it could really be any of them.
Yeah, I still don't buy Toadslow, but I'd be willing. I think this might be a thing where the fairy stuff may have come direct from Marcy, like, knowingly. But I would be willing to believe that the goblin stuff was just things they thought they were donating to the perimeter.
Yeah, especially because when would a fairy and a goblin work together? Am I right? No way.
Well, there was that time with the Oni that was very similar to this, but yeah,
that's true. Yeah. Anywho, one thing that's interesting that Edith says is, I'll be more useful in the later stages of tonight anyway. And there are, I think, one or two other beats like this that have some soft implications that actually their grand plan was going to unravel or unfold tonight anyway. Or maybe it's just Edith suggesting that she's stronger in general in the evenings, who knows. But it does seem like there's stuff that was already going to happen.
Yeah, she says a few things in the context of the invaders. Like, there's one part where she's like, we don't want the invaders getting the best of us and slowing us down. And it almost implies that the invaders getting the best of them is part of the plan. Like, maybe that's tinfoiling. I don't know. Like, this half of the conversation that we get is perfectly vague enough that you just are left with so much room to tinfoil. It's very fun.
Yep.
Yeah, there's there's a lot to dive in on. Like, there's a bit where she sort of implies they're probably going to try and send Crooked Rook after the trio. But Matt has to be careful she doesn't come after him as well. So I guess Crooked Rook maybe still sees him as a bit of a practitioner. Yeah, I mean, I hope they said Crooked Rook at them, because I want more Crooked Rook. Like, again, on the list of things 9.9 has made me sad, I don't think we're going to get quite as early as I expected. Some sort of deal with Crooked Rook is on that list.
Mm-hmm.
The memory visit with Alpi and Monty, sorry, with Tashlet and Monty is also probably an unfortunate casualty of 9.9's ending.
Yeah. Verona jumps over to the furs and sets up Silence Runes, and as the room falls silent, Verona takes a hammer and vents her frustration into the pipes, which burst, washing away the traps. Verona now stands in the water next to the furs.
I mean, it's so funny, because last week I sort of desperately tried to draw this connection between Matthew and Edith's basement and, like, how Lucy and Verona avoided working in Verona's dad's basement. I think I was a week early on the comparisons between Verona's dad's basement and Matthew and Edith's basement, because this one is a lot more transparent. She spent all this time creating artwork and an explosive fuse in her dad's basement this chapter, and then she comes here and vents her frustration in her dad by trashing Matthew and Edith's basement. Again, she's got sprinkly water, so that'll hopefully slow down Edith and allow Avery to get stabby.
Yeah, it's what an image it is, right? Like, Verona standing in this basement with the water flooding over her. Like, it is on paper a victory, but it feels, I don't even know, like, unhinged to me in a way that's so tangible. It's not cool and calculated. It's Verona slipping away almost with the glamour and everything being washed.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, this has sort of become a thing in the story. Like, Verona bottles everything up until she has these dumb explosions, as Lucy calls them. And I was sort of waiting from almost the start of this chapter. I was like, this feels like one of those chapters where we're going to get a Verona explosion. And I mean, yeah, this is it here. Like, she's gone in with no plan, no, like, safety. Like, as you said, like, this isn't calculated. This is just, she's emotional. And so she's run in here and caused a fucking mess. And, like, you know, it's like her hand is bleeding. It's also covered in ink. She's holding her mask in shards. Like, she talks about how her hair's a mess. Like, she is just deranged is a great word for how she must look, sort of sitting on this table with, like, all this shit going down, being sprayed by water. Like, she's just a force of chaos at this point. And it, you're right, visually, like, you just picture her on this table with the water spraying around and her looking, she'd have this crazy look in her eyes. Like, yeah.
Yeah. And that's the end of the...
Poor Snowdrop's just trying to be helpful.
Be helpful and not just abandon her to her unraveling, yeah. And that's where the chapter ends. What a chapter. What a great chapter.
Yeah, we'll see how this lives up to recency bias or whatever, but, like, I think I'm pretty much ready to lock this in as my favorite chapter in the story.
Yeah.
It's definitely between this and the implement ritual chapters.
Yeah. Yeah, good stuff. Then we get a bonus material, an extra material, which is a map of Kennet locations and past events. And it's great, but it's very visual and it's a recap of everything we already know. So I'm not sure there's much for us to talk about with it.
Yeah,
it's just kind of got key locations marked on it.
The two things that inhibit our ability to talk about extra material are both very present in this one. It's a handy little recap. I definitely lost a lot of that space. Like, I thought Tashlet lived a lot closer to the ferry than she does.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of little things like that it cleared up for me, and, like, seeing where the perimeter actually is was neat.
Yeah.
I enjoyed the art. I thought seeing Sharon get slammed in the text was always nice.
Yeah.
I can't remember who it was. The top Reddit comment on this when I went in there was, like, somebody saying, "Oh, finally some canon fan art of Ken," which is funny.
Classic comment, a top tier comment. it was great. But we don't have that much to say about it. So I guess that's the end of our show. Thanks for joining us, folks. But before we wrap up, let's dive into a discussion question, shall we?
Yeah. So this was sort of born of a discussion that came out of discussing what happened in 9.9 with Verona and her dad. So a discussion question is a pretty simple. Should Avery, Lucy, or Jasmine have done more about Verona's situation already?
Mm.
Maybe it's not fair to target those three. You could talk about other people if you want. But yeah, like I guess I'm curious what people think. Should something have already been done about this situation?
Yeah, I would also just love to hear. I'd love to hear more thoughts about what can be done about this situation now. You know. But yeah, leave your answers to that in the Reddit thread, which you'll find linked in the show notes down below. And in the show notes, you will find that discussion thread. Feel free to not just leave your comments on the discussion question, but leave your comments about the show in general or these chapters. This 9.9 was a big one, so there's a lot to dive into. So feel free to post some theories, some crazy wild theories into the Reddit thread.
Yes. You can also check out our Twitter. That's where we announce new episodes. We do the live reads and, you know, all sorts of other fun things. There'll probably be some pretty cool announcements coming out via that Twitter thread over the next few weeks. So, you know, worth following.
Yeah, definitely. You can also head to our website, doofmedia.com, where you can find all of the other great shows on the Doof Media Network. What You Say is about to, hopefully, assuming Elise doesn't have her baby beforehand, have their finale for season 3. It's going to be a great show. I'm anticipating a moment in the show where Elise goes into labor and things really go off the rails. And I just can't wait for that to happen in the finale of their season 3 discussion. Yeah,
my apologies to Elise, but I think just the quality of the content that will occur if she goes into
labor. The narrative arc of that going into labor during the show is just too good to not have it happen.
It's very soap opera too. Like, it's just perfect.
Yes. As we mentioned earlier, of course, you can go to doofmedia.com/discord to join in the conversation with all of these shows as well, if you would like to.
So don't forget to stop by our Patreon if you want to keep Doof Media operating as it is. We wouldn't be able to put all this time in without our patrons helping to support us. So patreon.com/doofmedia.
Yes, and while you're on Patreon, make sure you check out Wildbo's Patreon as well at patreon.com/Wildbo, because he makes all these great stories for us to play around in. 9.9 deserves some more patrons, so head over there if you haven't already and support him.
Whew. And I guess with that, we'll see you all next week for probably more Arc 9, probably about the end of it.
Who knows? Yeah.
See ya.
Bye.